You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
I was a soldier, then a veteran, a husband, and a father. And with my VA home loan, I'm a homeowner. No down payment required and no PMI. Build your future with the VA home loan. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for this hyper amount of benefits mentioned here.
All right, everybody, while we wait for our final speaker to get here, we're going to go ahead and get things rolling, starting off with some introductions of our panelists. So welcome, everyone, as always, to our July FOMC panel. There's a lot of things to touch on today, as there always is, and I'm really excited to get our panelists' takes on recent data and how things are looking moving forward. Let's jump right into some introductions here. First up, we've got Joseph Wang. Our go-to Fed guy, as many of you know, he headed the trading desk at the Fed's Open Markets Desk, has a great introductory book that I like to plug every time we have him up here, called Central Banking 101, and he's the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, Nicholas. Hey, Yanni Jewels, and hey, everyone on the panel. Thanks so much for having me. I always enjoy these discussions, and I always learn so much from all the other panelists.
As do I, and thank you as always for coming to lend your feedback, Joseph. Appreciate it every single time. Next, we've got the last bear standing, another frequent friend of the spaces. Last Bear is an expert on markets, and he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that Substack, go do that now. You'll be missing out on a lot of alpha. Welcome back, Last Bear, man. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, guys. Thanks as always for having me. It's good that we're getting into some potentially interesting FOMC meetings after a year of stalemate, let's say. So excited to hear from the panel today and having a good discussion.
As am I. Thanks, Last Bear. Next, we've got Michael Cao, the Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager of Cao Family Office, and an expert in commodities, convertible and capital structure arbitrage, and dynamic hedging. He's also one of the most quotable people on the planet. I know I save it every time, and I mean, it's been, months now? I still can't get over the pasta post that he did quite some time ago, because anytime Michael posts food, I'm instantly zoned in. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you. I'm always honored to be here. Love my fellow panelists here, and look forward to learning from all of you. Thank you.
And thank you. Next, we've got another frequent flyer of the Unusual Whales panels, Jem Carson. Jem is the leading volatility expert and founder of Kai Volatility. I know they've been launching a ton of new innovative things and tools, vol tools, mind you, so check them out for sure. Welcome back, Jem. I'm sure you'll have a lot to say about the recent weeks today.
Great to be here, guys. Good to be back. The love is mutual. Always learn from these fellas, and pivotal time here. I think it's a very interesting, important moment in market history right now. So excited to be here and talk about it.
You heard it here first, folks. Eyes up. And then our final panelist today is the return of Martin Pelletier. He's the portfolio manager at Trivest Wealth Council, an often columnist for the Financial Post, and an avid skier. Welcome back, Martin. Glad to have you back, man.
Awesome to be here. Thanks for the invite again, and to be with such esteemed colleagues is fantastic. And also, the only Canadian here, and hopefully I'll bring some backflips to the panel today.
So what I want to do here is give a quick overview before we just kind of get started. So since our last FOMC panel, in June of this year, the total non-farm payroll employment increased by around 206,000. The consumer price index in June rose 3% on an annual basis, slightly beating those estimates of 3.1% and down from 3.4% the month prior. The latest GDP print showed growth of plus 2.8% at an annual rate, completely shattering the prior quarter's print of 1.4%. And these data points have led some to again start speculating if that soft landing goal by the Fed may well still be possible. The markets have also experienced fairly high volatility over the last week or two, pulling back seemingly each day, although we do seem to be having a little bit of relief to the upside today. So here, Joseph, can you start us off here? In your recent Markets Weekly video, you touch on the GDP and what it means both for the economy and for Jerome Powell's soft landing goal. So to you, Joseph, is this new data that's just come out enough to go on to that end?
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me. I think that we have been living in soft landing for a couple years. Now, remember, the thinking a couple years ago when inflation was high was that the Fed would raise rates, that would crash the economy, and because of the recession, we would get inflation under control. Now, fast forward to today, again, as you mentioned, growth continues to be very good. 2.8% is above the economy's potential, and inflation is trending lower. It's been like this for a couple of years, so we are already living in soft landing, have been for some time. The question is if we fall off into recession or something else. Now, back to where the Fed is looking at this. Now, remember, the Fed's goal is full employment and price stability, basically their 2% inflation target. Now, when you think back to where the Fed was just a couple months ago, at their June FOMC, they had a dot plot, and they were guiding towards, based on their own views, they were thinking that at the end of the year, let's say core PCE would be about 2.8% year over year, and the unemployment rate would be about 4%. But no, fast forward to today, we are already, core PCE year over year is at 2.6%, so we are ahead of schedule, and the unemployment rate is climbing. It's most recently at 4.1%. So I think the Fed is really behind right now because, you know, everything is moving towards the right direction. Inflation is only a little bit above their target, but unemployment has been consistently rising for the past year. So there's a risk that we've been in soft landing for 2 years. Maybe we're tumbling into something worse if they continue to not adjust their stance of policy. So I think that's where we are today. And I would think that today we have another dovish pivot as they have tended to be sometime in time.
Thank you, Joseph. So I'm going to spin this a bit, and then I do want to touch on a few things that Joseph said as well. But first, Last Bear, in your June 14th article titled Growth Concerns, you said that, quote, absent convincing data to the contrary, I maintain the view that the economy is still on solid footing. How are things looking from your point of view now, Last Bear, following this, I would say, pretty substantial GDP beat on estimates?
Yeah, I don't think that my opinion has changed a whole lot from there, although I am very much aware of data points that sort of point to the opposite, like a rising unemployment rate. But I think that if you think about like employment, first of all, you have mixed data across different surveys, but the establishment survey and the ADP jobs numbers, which came out this morning, both continue to show solid job growth. Despite sort of what I would call sort of a slowdown in the circulation of jobs. So fewer people are quitting, fewer people are getting hired, but average payrolls are continuing to grow. The one area where we see, and I would also say that that's confirmed by initial claims and continued claims, staying at a sort of a relatively level base for the past year or so. The one place where you start to see deterioration is in the household survey, which is what the unemployment rate is calculated from. And that has obviously been ticking up to 4.1%, as Joseph mentioned, and sort of looks like the typical curve you see as you start to go into recession. So obviously, we shouldn't totally discount that sort of, an indication that looks like what we've seen in the past many times over heading into a recession. At the same time, I think that there's still a lot of data out there that suggests that the job market is generally growing, even if it's slowed to some degree. I think that it's hard to find a plurality of data that suggests that the economy is contracting or on the verge of contracting. And so I think that you've had a moderation for sure, coming out of sort of a hyper growth, coming out of the pandemic, or sort of recovering out of the pandemic to more of a normalized level. But I'm not in the position that we see enough data to suggest that a recession is imminent. That being said, I do think that the Fed is weighing their dual mandate. As Joseph mentioned, you know, obviously inflation has continued to play ball in sort of the second quarter after being quite stubborn in the first quarter and looking like potentially inverting higher. But the recent data points, I think, has given the Fed room to feel comfortable easing from what they consider to be a restrictive policy as of right now.
Now, before I move to the next question, does anybody have anything to comment on Joseph or Last Bear's points there? Go ahead, Michael.
Sure, I'd like to weigh in here. I'm more of in the Last Bear camp here. The way I see things, that yes, we have been in this Goldilocks period, but as I tweeted a couple of weeks ago in a discussion with Bob Elliott, I think Goldilocks can easily morph into her uglier twin sister, which I've been calling anti-Goldilocks, which is a scenario where growth is just strong enough to make it difficult for the Fed to really embark on an easing cycle with confidence without essentially loosening financial conditions like that December rhetorical pivot did.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
But it's just weak enough to potentially cause earnings misses in a lot of these high-valued stocks, and also start creating demand weakness in pro-cyclical commodities, which we have been seeing over the last several weeks. Today's geopolitical spike in oil notwithstanding. So I think what's causing this confusion, it's a very confusing time in the world of macro, because I think the data kind of provides something for everyone to latch onto, right? And the heart of this confusion, I think, is that between, you know, sometime last year, you know, I wrote this piece called The Four Horsemen of U.S. Economic Resilience, and honing in on the main culprit, I would say, is this fiscal push-pull between, you know, the Fed and the Treasury, and this vodka Red Bull effect, right? I've been using this mental model for a while, saying that, you know, the fiscal Treasury Department has essentially been pouring on the fiscal Red Bull while the Fed has been trying to pour on the monetary depressant, and the two have been fighting one another. And I'm sure everybody's read that great paper from Nouriel Roubini and Stephen Moran that essentially quantifies some of the effects of just some of the QRA games that Treasury has been playing. But what about the fiscal pump? I mean, you know, between the three spending bills, the Inflation Reduction Act, CHIPS Act, and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, that's $2.2 trillion of fiscal earmarks. So it's creating this situation where the Fed has been fighting, Treasury has been fighting the Fed the entire time. And it's making the Fed's job very, very difficult. I think in the long run, what this is going to do is it's actually going to cost taxpayers more in the long run instead of just letting the monetary tightening cycle do its job. And the one last thing I'll say here in my introductory remarks is that, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, the Fed's dual mandate and, you know, we're probably tipping into recession. And I would just say that, you know, to actually get inflation down, one needs to take a hammer to aggregate demand. And you're seeing some signs of that, but you're not seeing it happen en masse. From my stance, I don't really see the dual mandate of the Fed coming into conflict yet. And I am surprised. I originally thought that you know, we would have it be having these discussions about the dual mandate coming into conflict by the end of 23. Totally wrong on that. But from where I stand now, especially when you see how sanguine credit conditions are, when you look at other data points like industrial production, capacity utilization, all of these metrics are very, very benign, in my opinion. And for the Fed, the much bigger policy mistake I see here is a premature pivot, which sets the stage for a return to hikes in 2025.
Thank you, Michael. Anybody have any responses to Michael's points? Maybe Martin.
Yeah. So I'm more in line with Joseph that we've been in a soft landing for some time now. If you look at job openings, you know, it was 1.2 openings for every unemployed worker back in June. And that's the lowest in the post-pandemic period. So obviously hiring has slowed further. And the private sector hiring fell 3.7% in June. I think we're seeing, I mean, it's really interesting. I think it's quite dangerous to say to ignore the U.S. election upcoming here. We have the Main Street that is suffering. You have the U.S. economy still chugging along, and not excessively, but chugging along. And so I call it a two-speed economy, where asset owners are doing quite well, but low-income consumers are struggling to keep up. And they've had a heck load of a lot of inflation, and you know, they're struggling to get by. And so the fiscal policy is trying to deal with that, which may be extending and making the problem worse. And so you're going to have to deal with that. And I think, you know, if you look at two-year treasuries, we should see the right thing to do is a 50 basis point rate drop in September. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think that's the more likely target scenario that we should be looking at. And then it gets really interesting because as a Canadian and the developed world, we're anchoring ourselves to the Fed, and it's going to have all kinds of currency implications.
Michael, I see your hand there again. We'll take your points here, and then there's something that we've talked about pretty much since the start that I want to touch on. So go ahead, Michael.
I apologize. That was a mistake. Sorry.
Oh, fair enough. So I want to touch on the dual mandate here real quickly, namely the unemployment rate. So the unemployment rate in June rose to a three-year high of 4.1%, marking 6.8 million unemployed people, which is up from about 3.6% just a year ago. Now, my question on this is, does this rising unemployment rate say anything in regards to the Fed's dual mandate? And this is one I do want to get the whole panel's thoughts on, but let's start with Jim here.
So a couple of things. One, I think we know, and we've talked about on here, that there's a significant lag to monetary policy, right? We've been seeing that lag in real time. Many people expected a slowdown right earlier this year. What we haven't talked about, and what people, in my opinion, don't talk enough about, are the connections between capital markets themselves and the economy. Everybody talks about the economy as if it's kind of on its own, and then that financial markets then are just the effect. They, you know, what financial markets do is a representation of somehow the economy, but very few people really think enough, in my opinion, about the wealth effect and the factors that drive markets in markets that drive the economy. I think, you know, earlier this year, just as a retrospective, you know, last December, when the Fed all of a sudden started talking about six cuts, everybody, all of a sudden the market took off, right? And that market effect had a significant, what I would call, money supply effect on the economy. And all of a sudden the economic numbers started looking a lot better, right? Inflation numbers were a bit stickier, et cetera. Now, since the market's slowed down and is teetering a bit here, I think that raises the question of what happens when the market goes down. I think everybody talks about markets as almost like a forward-looking entity, like they're smarter than the economy. But very few people realize that the market itself is forward-looking, not because it's smarter and because of the wisdom of crowds, in my opinion. It's because it actually drives the economic effects to a great extent. You know, to give people context, you know, we're dealing with a $100 trillion equity market and another $100 to $200 trillion in assets that are tied to the equity markets. You know, if we have $200 trillion in equities that decrease 10% in value, let's say in a month, you know, they're talking about $20 trillion reduction in money supply. Nobody thinks about it that way, but that's the reality. Your collateral in the system decreases by 20%. So I think a primary driver that for why the economy has been a bit stronger than people have expected until more recently, as well as now some of the weakness we're beginning to see on the other end, are in a significant way driven by this wealth effect. Again, I don't even like the term wealth because I don't think it's as much about wealth. It's just about collateral. The amount of collateral money supply in the system dramatically decreases in a leveraged environment. That's critical in a leveraged system, right? Banks are driven on, you know, the whole system is built on leverage. When that collateral reduces, the whole liquidity in the system decreases. So I know that's not a direct answer to what you've been talking about, but I think it's a useful tool to think about when you're thinking about markets, everybody, and the economy. Another thing I'll highlight, which I think is very important, is the asymmetry that now exists from cuts. Everybody thinks these reactions are linear, that if we raise rates, there's a linear kind of positive effect to the negative effect to the economy, and it slows down the economy. And if we lower rates, it'll linearly in the same amount increase demand in the economy. That's not how it works, and particularly in this current environment. In the 70s, it was a similar environment. When the interest rate reductions come, it will be a significant support to the economy, much more than it has been a hindrance on the upside, particularly through the real estate channel.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
People locked in really low rates. As interest rates went up, it has driven less transactions in the real estate, in real estate broadly. That said, it is not creating a liquidation or anything along those lines. There's a pent-up demand that is building underneath the hood. People need to continue to buy homes. They need to continue to move into homes, and people are just unable to. They're stuck in their homes, et cetera. So a 1% decrease in the interest rate will, in my opinion, unleash much more economic support than people are expecting. And so the reaction function to cuts in the economy and in markets is significant as well. And I think that's part of what we saw again in December when the market started pricing dramatic cuts. We saw a lot of increases in home, household creation, et cetera. So that paired with again the wealth effect is a very strong combination and has played a significant role. Now again, the question is now they've both been going in the same direction. Now if markets do end up getting some type of liquidation sometime in the next 6 months or a year, something happens, we get a significant pullback. It will be a bit of a push pull between the Fed's reaction on and the significant firepower they have with interest rates at this point, and the asymmetric effects that they can have there relative to the negative wealth effect, which is significant. As of now, up until recently this year, they've both been firing in the same direction. That's why we've seen net positive outcomes. So I'll leave that there instead of keep going on. But I think those are the two most important things to be thinking about as we debate kind of where is the economy going, where is the market going. And ironically, it's not the underlying worker and, you know, the economy and production as much as people like to think about. It really is a lot of the specific effect of interest rates relative to the wealth effect. I think that are two of the most important effects.
So real quick here, actually, Jim, before we pass the torch to another panelist, your mention of a significant pullback. In the last 2 weeks or so, the NASDAQ fell as low, I think, as 7% from the highs. Would you consider that a significant pullback, or what kind of scope are we looking at here?
I mean, this is not a significant pullback. It needs to last for some time. Time matters as well. Again, not nearly deep enough to create some of the effects that we're talking about. But I think the Fed has to be watching markets. I know everybody thinks that they don't, or they wouldn't at least ever admit to it. But they do control money supply at the end of the day. That is their primary tool. And they already obviously, you know, enter financial markets to support the market. And so I think they're watching closely. I think this bounce today is interesting, right? I have to think that the current volatility, a little bit of the negative wealth effect, given the fears that were already kind of the data that was already starting to build on the economy, has to be something that motivates them to be a bit more aggressive and to get out in front of cuts. You know, I would expect some stronger language than that we've been hearing recently in terms of trying to support the economy. But again, these things can be very fast, and they can move between meetings very quickly, much quicker than the Fed can move these days. And the wealth effect is significant. So no, I think you'd need more. Again, there's a lot of positive things supporting the market in this window. We can get into more micro weekly, monthly flows and what's driving this pullback, which I think is important because ultimately that does feed into the wealth effect, which has a significant effect, you know, later on here. But no, that is not enough in terms of size and scale. I think it'll have an incremental effect on the Fed's commentary today, personally. And I think if we get some more, which I think is highly is very possible, and I would say even likely in the next month, that could then have a significant acceleration effect to the Fed being more aggressive in September than people expect.
Well said, Tim. Thank you. Michael, any points to add to any of that? I know we kind of deterred a little bit, but I really wanted to get his take there.
Yeah, sure. I think, look, the Fed has a very blunt tool, right? And the reality of the world right now is it's far more nuanced than that. And I want to hone in on this whole notion of haves versus have-nots that I wrote about a couple of months ago. Because, you know, this push-pull between the Fed and Treasury have created some large distortions. And within the U.S. economy, the distortions between haves and have-nots is, of course, there's on the consumer side of things, there's a big difference between the low-end consumer and the high-end consumer. We all know that, and we see it, right? The low-end consumer is really, really getting crushed by inflation of any demographic. And then while the wealthy have actually gotten wealthier, right? Because of just, you know, the performance in equities and asset prices, et cetera. On the corporate side of things, you're seeing the same bifurcation because you have levered sectors, right? People that have floating rate debt, CRE. So you know, the most bearish data points that you're seeing are coming from these beleaguered sectors. But then you have the haves, which are, for instance, like Mag 7, you know, companies that don't have much debt or have locked in their financing, right? And you know, same thing on the consumer side, right? There are people who most people in the U.S. have locked in long-term mortgages, right? So these are the bifurcations within the U.S. economy. Now let's look at the bifurcations between the U.S. economy and the rest of the world. And in a way, they're even more stark, because I'm looking at a table here on COIFIN. I'll just cite three data points. The United States, GDP, quarter over quarter, you know, annualizing at 2.8%, CPI still around 3%, jobless rate around 4.1%. How about the Eurozone? GDP, quarter over quarter of 0.3%, CPI at 2.6, jobless rate of 6.4. Japan, GDP of negative 50 basis points, inflation at around 2.8, and jobless rate of 2.5%. So in aggregate, where is the urgency to cut coming from? And so that goes back to what, Nicholas, what you were asking about, the dual mandate and the rise in unemployment. Well, let's put that into perspective too. 3.5% is where kind of we started, right? And that was an all-time low. We're now at 4.1%, but if you look at the huge surge in illegal immigration, I have to think that that's also impacted that particular metric. And, you know, I haven't done the numbers, but I'm guessing that were it not for this massive surge in illegal immigration, you probably would have an unemployment rate that's still below 4% right now, meaning that there are some of these other distortions that are happening that are making it look like there's more slack in the economy than there is. Because when you look at recent bounces in industrial production and capacity utilization, it's not and the big bounce in this in the last GDP estimates, they're not jiving with a huge slowdown in aggregate demand. That's those are my points.
Lesper or Martin, anything to add?
Yeah, I'll jump in here. I agree with a lot of what was just said. You know, if you look at the dual mandate, if you look at inflation, I firmly believe it's under control. The solution, I spent 8 years covering energy markets, and good old saying is the solution to high prices is high prices. Consumers are hurting. Food and energy inflation is prices are up 25% to 30% from pre-pandemic levels. And you can see the consumer responding, looking at the McDonald's results more recently. You have 44 million Americans that are going hungry. That's one in five children. So you've got Main Street that's really struggling. And so if you look at where the have and the have-nots, by lowering rates, and I think it isn't a coincidence that at the beginning of the month, we saw the rotation out of the cash heavy, the ones that are benefiting, the megas that are benefiting from higher rates. We're seeing the rotation out of the megas into other segments like the Russell 2000 or the equal weight. And that's better for Main Street, in my opinion. And you need about 4 to 5 rate cuts in 12 months to support PE multiples that are our consensus earnings per share growth for the segment. For those segments are going to go from like 3% up to 12 to 36%. So, you know, it's going to benefit Main Street by seeing that rotation and capital going into the broader economy stocks out there. And that would be very supportive. And we're also seeing that internationally as well, too. It was a good point about immigration. And we'll talk about immigration because in Canada, if you guys were running the same levels of immigration in the U.S., you'd see 13 million people come into the country. I mean, it's just...
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call. Because real protection means showing up. Even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Absolutely insane what's happening up here. Our GDP per capita is on a per capita basis has been shrinking. Calgary is where I am in Alberta is like Texas. It's booming. We have an 8.8% unemployment rate because of massive immigration. And if you look at Canada's growth, we've had the worst growth out of the 50 developed countries' economies, and that's expected to continue. And inflation-adjusted wages have been flat since 2016. And so we have a situation where Canada is really struggling compared to the U.S. economy that's doing really – is doing, in perspective, a lot better. And you're seeing that in our currency with falling 10 cents or 13% from its May 2021 high. And on the flip side, from our perspective, we could see it breach 70 cents, which is absolutely crazy. And so there's a lot of the have versus the have nots. It's really important to recognize that as an investor.
Thank you, Martin. And I was actually going to follow up on the Canadian context there as well, but you jumped right in. So thank you for that. It's really nice to have that international insight as well. Last Bear, any points you want to add there before I kick a new question over to Joseph?
I guess I would just touch on, I think, some of the market commentary, obviously. I think Martin just sort of touched a little bit on it as well. But, you know, we did see a massive rotation, I'd say, with the CPI print for the June period that was released, I think, on July 10th. That sort of sparked a massive, massive rotation out of the big tech and into basically everything else, not just Russell 2000, but anything that was outside of sort of the you know, the top 5-10 names that had been sort of accruing most of the gains throughout the year. And so even though the index was down, I wrote about at the time that the actions or the price action broadly, if you look across the market, the breadth was huge. Momentum across all different stocks became significantly more positive. And obviously that continued to rip as a trade for the following 2 weeks. Obviously the Russell 2000 still sort of poking out at new highs, or at least new highs for the past 2 years or so. The Dow Jones is up at, you know, record highs, outperforming the S&P, which obviously is being driven down by the underperformance of tech over the past 2 weeks. But that price action to me is not one that indicates macroeconomic fears, even if the S&P 500 is down 5% or whatever from, you know, over the past 2 weeks. So you don't see fear, in my opinion, in the equity market broadly. You wouldn't see small caps rallying into recession fears. You don't see really any movement on rates that has been really material, or credit spreads also very tight. So again, I would just say with respect to the market, I do think that it's been really a rotation story, even though the index has, the benchmark index is down.
Thank you, Last Bear. So what I want to do here, it's kind of a bit of a pivot back to the top of the panel on the topic of rate cuts and recent data. So Jerome Powell has said on numerous occasions over the last month or two that he has a high desire to see more evidence that inflation is falling toward his target. And it kind of ties back to my initial question to Joseph on whether or not recent data is enough to go on. I want to give a little bit more international context here. So in addition to... shut my mic off on accident there. So the Bank of Canada, they cut their rates by 25 basis points, bringing their key interest rate to 4.5%. And that marks the second time that Canada has cut this year. On the other hand, the Bank of Japan announced an additional rate hike of 25 bips. So I'm going to start with Joseph here. What are the odds, from your perspective, that we see the United States cutting today, as well as the speculation on cutting in September? And what, if any, do the decisions of both Japan and Canada suggest about inflation outside of the United States?
So there's no chance we cut today. That's just not the Fed style. I mean, as we all know, the Fed doesn't like to surprise the markets. They always like to have everything telegraphed in advance. Now, some central banks, like the Swiss National Bank, they'll cut and then they'll tell you that they forgot to tell you and the market would overreact. But the Fed is not like that. They're very, very slow. And so I think it's very likely that they would strongly suggest that we would have a rate cut in September. That's their style. They would move slowly and have the market be prepared. So when it comes to inflation abroad, I think you pointed out two very different cases. In Japan, inflation is becoming more of a problem. you can hear people complaining over there about the weaker currency, lowering living standards. But elsewhere, let's say in Euroland, in Canada, and so forth, and in the US, inflation has been coming down a lot. I don't actually think that the Fed is influenced too much about what those other central banks do. I think it's very much the other way around. So a lot of central banks try to react to the Fed. Now, I think just to have some more context as to why it makes sense for the Fed to be cutting as they have been strongly hinting for some time, I think it's helpful to focus more on their mandate rather than aggregate growth. Now, as Michael mentioned, we have all these things happening in our economy that really haven't happened before. One is that we have the increase of literally millions and millions of people. And that's making a lot of the data skewing it a bit in the sense that we can have, for example, rising unemployment, but also have strong GDP. Why is that? Well, we have more people working, obviously more people working, strong GDP, but obviously also more people here looking for jobs. That's going to have upward pressure on the unemployment rate, even as demand for labor slows. Now, the Fed's mandate is not just low unemployment rates for U.S. citizens, but it's just full employment. And honestly, from the aggregate data, you really can't tell the difference. So in that sense, you're kind of in a really good place when it comes to the risk markets, where you have rising unemployment due to increases in supply that forces a more dovish stance. And at the same time, you have growth very positive. Now, looking at the other mandate, like you mentioned, Nicholas, Jerome Powell wanted to see more good data. Now, there are two paths to get rate cuts. One is unemployment rate, which again is already above the June dot plot estimate. But I think we have had really good data over the past couple of months when it comes to inflation. Core PCE, already 2.6%. Honestly, that's not that much higher than 2%. Now, from the Fed's perspective, you have to weigh this and think, well, you know, somewhat balanced, not too far from target. Where should monetary policy be? It should definitely be restrictive, without doubt. We don't want to be easing policy. But how restrictive? That's the question. Does it make sense for us to be at multi-decade highs in terms of interest rates? I think their perspective is no. It makes sense to have some kind of adjustment. And this is also, like you mentioned, in line with what many other countries experiencing similar conditions to the Fed have been doing. Canada cut rates twice, Switzerland cut rates twice, ECB cut rates. Now, I think Jim is making a really good point about the wealth effect. So we could all see that in our own trading accounts, right? So S&P goes up. If you're a levered investor, that means you have more equity to put down and buy even more. Everyone does this. Markets go even higher. It's a self-perpetuating cycle. Maybe that's why we have these momentum impacts. But I think from the Fed's perspective, from all I hear, they don't really care too much about the wealth effect. It's really about unemployment and price stability. I don't think they think that it impacts the economy that much. The reason I think this is that they've had plenty of times to directly address the loosening financial conditions that everyone in the market perceives, right? Stocks all-time highs, credit markets very tight. Now, when asked this, Governor Waller basically said, yeah, markets are high, but that's really just a handful of stocks, right? The Mag 7. I can't conduct monetary policy on the basis of what NVIDIA is doing. Or when it comes to tight credit spreads, he responded, well, you know, that's technical stuff, increase in competition from private credit, driving credit spreads to be very narrow. If you look at mortgage rates, they're still high. If you look at credit card rates, they're still high. Delinquencies are also rising as well. So I agree that the wealth effect is impactful, especially for the more affluent half of the population that owns a lot of assets. That's going to increase their consumption. Looking in my city, you know, in Las Vegas, the luxury homes, honestly, you have to get in line to buy one. But the average ones, it's, you know, not as affordable because people who buy average homes need mortgages. So that is something that's kind of a dichotomy in economy, as Michael mentioned. And I think the Fed is probably going to side more with just the median person rather than worrying about the top half having too much.
Thank you, Joseph. And I do have a couple of follow-ups to some of the points Joseph made there. But first, I want to pass this around the panel. Michael, is your hand up for real this time?
It is.
Let's go.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to bring the role of the dollar into this discussion because I think it's an important one. So you know, in recent weeks, right, especially with when Trump election odds were really, really surging. And then I think he and J.D. Vance were talking about, you know, the dollar's too strong and potentially weakening the dollar. It prompted me to write a thread, which is pinned on my Substack. I said, okay, is this the transition between it, from the U.S. dollar wrecking ball to the U.S. dollar pickleball, right? A downgrade of the strength of the dollar. And in my mind, the dollar is basically, being the global reserve currency, it's an equilibrating mechanism for inflation. And a strong dollar effectively exports inflation to the rest of the world. And you've seen the effects of that, right? So we're talking about how, you know, Japan is finally starting to contend with higher inflation. Well, they've been contending with the twin wrecking balls of high commodity prices and high dollar, right? And that's starting to impact their monetary policy. But here's where I see the danger in what a weaker dollar would bring. Because in my thread, I basically wrote that there are three ways to weaken the dollar. There's one path, which is overt devaluation, a la the Plaza Accords of 1985, where the U.S. and I think France and Germany and U.K. and Japan basically got together and said, hey, the U.S. dollar is way too strong and we need to correct trade imbalances and, you know, and intervene directly. Just note that the DXY at that time hit 165 versus the 104 level today. I see that as a very, very low probability event. So then the second way to weaken the dollar is that the Fed has to now outdove the rest of the world. And I've had the opposite view that I've laid out in my past comment that the economic conditions here relative to the rest of the world actually justify the rest of the world outdoving the Fed. So the way the Fed would outdove the rest of the world is that they would have to not just prematurely pivot, they would have to start pivoting more aggressively and easing more aggressively than the rest of the world. But what's the problem with scenarios one and two, an overt devaluation and a premature pivot? Both are in effect stimulative to the U.S. economy again. We wind up re-importing the inflation we've tried so hard to export over the last 3 years. So those, I think, are self-defeating ultimately. And so you're talking about commodity prices. Well, you're going to see commodity prices spike if the direction of causality is to either overtly devalue the dollar or to prematurely pivot, and it becomes self-defeating. My golden path scenario that I wrote about is scenario three, where if there were a geopolitical trade where we wind up doing a security deal with Saudi Arabia and get them to loosen global balances because they've unilaterally held up oil prices with 3 million barrels per day in cuts. If you address the oil problem and why oil is so important, because it is the primary feedstock for the global economy, right? Not just for transportation, but petrochemicals and every distillate under the sun and manufacturing costs and whatnot. If you can address the oil problem and get oil back into the 50s and 60s, that is the scenario where the Fed can then start embarking on an easing cycle that doesn't backfire. So that's my opinion.
Thank you, Michael. Last bear, Martin, anything to add there before I pick on Jem some more?
Yeah, I'm gonna pick on Canada for a bit because you know, the strong dollar exporting inflation is bang on. Canada consumes like $300 billion a year out of the U.S. And so the Bank of Canada is really facing quite the challenge here with consumers. And I mean, we're among the most levered households in the developed world in Canada. And we had to because housing prices just continued to skyrocket. And you know, we have immigration, for example, in Ontario, in the last six months, the population's gone up by 200,000 in Ontario, and there's only been 36,000 home starts. And so And then from a taxation perspective, if you look at the average income in Canada, they pay more in taxes than they do on food and clothing and housing, and so combined. So we need to get interest rates down to help the main consumer here. That's why we saw two rate cuts. I think they'd like to go more, but they can't because of the currency. And so it would be ideal to see the Fed go 50 in September, and that would be very beneficial to us in Canada who are trying to get by day to day.
Thank you, Martin. Les Bear, anything to add to anybody's points here so far before I move along?
No, I think everyone covered it pretty well.
Good deal. So I want to kind of go back to talking about the markets just a little bit here. I know we've got about 10 minutes before data release, but I want to talk about gold in relation to the markets. And we've discussed gold numerous times before, but it stays, you know, kind of a hot topic for, I would say, a lot of good reasons. So with Jem here, you've said before that gold vol is an incredibly optimal trade. And we have observed, like I said, gold setting new highs numerous times this year. So I'm curious, Jem, what your thoughts are on gold and what it means for the markets at large. And kind of in addition to this, a recent report by Bank of America Global Research shows that gold flows in the Western world are substantially growing. And the Bank of America itself has spoken of a $3,000 an ounce price target within the next 12 to 18 months. And so I'm curious on your thoughts there, Jem.
Yeah, I mean, so just to kind of look backwards here, last year gold had been kind of left for dead. Everybody kind of knew the long-term realities that we were kind of structured going into, but positioning was too long of gold, and so gold had to do kind of somewhat of a nonsensical thing, which was to kind of slowly decline and bleed people out. Well, at that point, after it kind of sat there for a while, what became clear was not that gold would eventually rally based on the structural and macro realities that were in place. That was our view. But the more important dislocation was that gold vol itself was just way too low for the regime that we were going into. It's easier to predict distribution than it is to predict direction on a shorter term, medium term basis. So that was why we made, that spot on call when gold was really at its lows early last year, to be long of gold calls. And sure enough, we saw massive convexity into a move. What's happened since then? A lot more talk about gold, a lot more bullish positioning, and so we've kind of digested. We're trying to shake some of that positioning. The moves are always counterintuitive before they work. We could talk about the Russell and the AI moves and everything that happened as well. People have known that that was a dislocation, but positioning had to get shaken out. So point is, gold vol was way too cheap, especially upside calls. That is the play for the next decade. I want to be clear. This is not a 3-month call. This is not a 6-month call. No pun intended. This is structurally inflationary period. Gold does well, but more important than gold doing well, gold is very volatile. It moves in multiple different directions. Also, a buy and vol would be in FX land. Pairs trades. The dollar should become more volatile with time as well. What's not volatile? Industrial commodities. We're running a demand push economy. We're also seeing a geopolitical strife. Entities that have control over commodity pricing will underpin their prices at all costs during these periods. So the trade has been sell oil and industrial vol puts. When that vol was high, that was the thing to sell, and to buy gold and precious metal calls. That trade on both sides has been an incredible winner. That will continue to be the case. Very unintuitive trade, people think, oh, they're both commodities. Why would I sell vol in one and buy one vol in the other? But they are completely different centers. One is more of a commodity in terms of industrial input to the economy, whereas the other is much more of a financial asset. So, you know, in the 70s and other periods like this, we saw not just dramatic upside moves, but again, a dramatic upside volatility. I would say in the short term, there's a lot of people talking about it, right? Nobody was talking about it when I was, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago. So things can be counterintuitive. And I wouldn't be surprised if gold is weak before it's strong again. But it's going to move in very disjointed ways. You know, I think the biggest thing to think about now, too, is the election. You know, interestingly enough, we've been on here for almost an hour, and we've almost talked none about the election. We're in the middle of quite possibly one of the most pivotal elections in the global economy, you know, in the last 50 plus years. This is a critical, and why is it so important? This is not a political comment. It really is. It's an important election because of what the policy represents. A Trump presidency would be protectionist. We mentioned immigration. That is a huge, huge deal. The current administration and arguably the Democratic continuation of it would be, despite what the politics would say, an open immigration policy. That immigration policy is one of the few things that the U.S. has to relieve structural inflationary pressures that are coming from moving away from a globalist system and working with China. It is, you know, in Donald Trump's view, that immigration is a problem. If we try and close the borders and have increasingly protectionist policy, that is structurally very, very inflationary and will create a more stagflationary environment. That paired with Fed activism coming likely from the Trump administration, you know, if Trump is elected, those three things are a three-legged stool that are structurally very, very inflationary and more importantly, a very, very big for gold volatility. You're going to have a lot of cross currents that are really going to try and push people out of the dollar if we're getting increasing Fed activism, while also push people in to risk, you know, protecting places like away from the dollar, but also still dealing with the inflationary pressure. So gold benefits from a risk off. It benefits from you know, inflationary periods, as well as a loss of faith in the dollar. And all those things are tailwinds if we do see a Trump presidency. So a couple different points there, but I think those are all very important.
Thank you, Jim. Martin, you had something to add there as well?
Yeah, I'll be quick. If you look at gold itself, and I admittedly, I missed the trade. You know, prior to October 7th of 2023, you can see that gold had an inverse relationship with USD, and then all of a sudden that became delinked. And so since the heightened geopolitical side in the Middle East, gold's up 12% from then, and oil's actually down 10%. We made the we were long oil instead of gold on the geopolitical, and we were wrong. And you can see it happening even today with the political leader of Hamas getting taken out in the middle of Tehran, and gold's up another 1% today. And so that's really interesting. And if I think geopolitical is probably going to get worse before it gets better, and so that'll be favorable to gold.
Thank you, Martin. Michael.
The main pushback I have against the inflationary Trump tailwinds is the impact that he'll have on oil. So I always go back to oil because I think oil is the most critical commodity. And I've been saying for a while that I think the real geopolitical risk to oil is not to the upside like these knee-jerk rallies today. In fact, I'm trying to fade today's rally. The real geopolitical downside is a replay of what happened in Q4 2018. I call that the Trump rug pull. If you guys may not remember that, but basically when Trump pulled us out of JCPOA, he basically promised that there would be no waivers. He then got MBS to basically flood the market. And then at the 11th hour, he wound up granting 11 waivers and absolutely crushed the price of oil. I think that given that Saudi Arabia has no exit strategy, really, from their unilateral cuts, I think that the geopolitical risk of some sort of deal that a Trump administration might do with Saudi Arabia is a significant geopolitical risk that is completely poo-pooed by the market. So I would push back and say that in general, a Trump presidency will be bad for oil prices. So that would counter a bunch of the other things that we talked about.
Thank you, Michael. Joseph, something to add there? And I know we have the data drop here in just a minute, and we'll be keeping an eye on that as well.
Yeah, so I just want to quickly add to Jim's point about the election. I honestly think this is cliche, but it will be the most consequential election we've had for some time. The reason being that right now what I've noticed is that the White House has more and more power that they didn't have before. For example, as Jim mentioned, we noticed that, you know, the White House can just kind of stop enforcing immigration law and increase the population by millions and millions. So depending on who's in the White House, we could have a very, very different population count in the coming years. Secondly, we also, you know, as Stephen Moran and Rubini wrote, you know, if you're in the White House, you can kind of adjust how the Treasury issues debt, and that has influences on the financial conditions. Now imagine you are a president that wants easy financial conditions, lower rates, Fed doesn't want to listen to you. Okay, let's say that I issue 30% of all my debt in Treasury bills. How does that impact financial conditions? I think that would have a big impact. So, you know, these are all tools available to elected office now. So whoever holds the office has a lot more power over the markets and the economy than before.
So as I'd say, everybody expected coming into this panel, it looks like the Fed has held rates.
You know, straight off, you have some dovish language. So instead of describing inflation as elevated, it's somewhat elevated, again, tempering that down. And again, becoming more aware of the two sides of the mandate. So in the past, it's always been inflation. Now we also have to take into account unemployment. Now Chair Powell has been telegraphing this during his testimony. So on average, obviously, as we all expect, this is a step in the more dovish direction.
Yeah, I would say that there's really no surprises here. Not that there was really an expectation of too much surprise, but again, slight easing of language, holding rates in QT where they have been, and obviously I think the big news, if anything, will come in how Powell responds to questions and whether he provides more hinting at September cut next meeting. The only other thing I would add, I think, just as we think about rate cuts moving forward, is I think, you know, people have talked about it earlier on this call, but the idea that the Fed is putting out a good amount of forward guidance and officially through their dot plot and unofficially through their commentary and these sort of signaling devices, and obviously the market responds to that and has been responding to that. And so I think as the market has priced in cuts in September, and through the end of the year, potentially up to two cuts through the end of the year, we have to think about the incremental change for, you know, if the Fed deviates from what the market is pricing. So if they were to hold at this level, it's really not holding at this level. It would be a hawkish pivot higher from where the sort of market is pricing, where conditions are today. And I think that's probably unlikely given the circumstances.
So I'm seeing some pundits. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I'm going to go out on a limb and take the under on the 100% odds of September.
That's just what I was about to bring up as well, Michael. That's the rating in of 50 bips come September. What's everybody's comments on that? I see Martin's hand and Joseph's hand, but honestly, I don't trust the hand anymore. So unless someone's already talking, guys, feel free to speak freely.
I was watching on the announcement here. I was looking at the third paragraph and the sentence that the committee does not expect it will be appropriate reduce target range until it's gained greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2%. That key guidance was introduced back in beginning of the year in January 2024, and that hasn't changed. And that was something I was really keeping an eye on. So you're right. Maybe it's not 100% for September.
Jem or Joseph, anything to add here from what you're seeing in the release before we kind of pivot the conversation again?
No, it doesn't seem to have changed market implied pricing. I mean, I don't think there's any chance we would have 50 unless something really bad happened. But I think the base case price in the market is still we have 25 in September.
All right. So what I kind of want to do here is it's a little bit of a callback to the gold discussion, but this time in relation to the U.S. Treasury market. So some have said that a lot of this bullish outlook on gold also stems from a fear of U.S. Treasury market fragility. And before I get too deep on that, because there's actually a couple of pretty hot topics I want to touch on with the Treasury, I'm sure Joseph knows where I'll be going with that part. But just to the panel as a whole here, are the U.S. Treasuries weakening to start us off? Les Bear, I'd love your thoughts here.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about Treasury pricing, I think that it's been pretty strong over the past, couple months as anticipation of rate cuts continues to solidify. I think that there's been a lot of discussion around how the Treasury works independently from the Fed, how they choose their, the duration of their issuances and whatnot, and whether or not the Treasury is sort of acting in a way that counterbalances the Fed. I think it's important to remember that obviously the Treasury doesn't decide spending decisions. It's a congressional decision. So they choose how to finance things, but ultimately if they're, raising monies because it's been earmarked by Congress, they're in the position of doing that in the most efficient way possible. And I think that there is an argument to be made around the fact that, it's been sort of an easy sledding for the Treasury over the past year, in part because they were able to basically access reserves that were sort of lost in the reverse repo facility by issuing a large number of bills. And it's made it fairly easy for the Fed for the Treasury to fund their deficits. And they kind of had an easy pocket of cash that was sitting on the sideline to be able to tap into and do that. And I think a lot of people have seen that and suggested that that's, an indication that the Treasury is sort of trying to game the system in order to put more money like short duration securities into the mix. And I guess my perspective on that is that it's really been about optimal funding and the fact that they were trying to sort of tap into the reverse repo facility and sort of just issuing debt that they have to issue in the most efficient way possible.
Michael, see your hand there?
Yeah, that's a real hand. I just want to say that, so I have no position in gold, no dog in this hunt, but I want to make some observations. So back in, during the Asian contagion 1.0, 97-98 period, you would think that, amidst competitive currency devaluations, gold would be a safe haven. It actually did the opposite, went down. And I think the reason was because at that point, U.S. 10-year was yielding significantly higher. We had a normally shaped yield curve. And so probably it was a more competitive reserve asset. Reason why I think that's relevant to today is that I do think that the danger of a premature pivot is especially when inflation expectations are not fully tamped down. And I'll mention that that recent UMichigan survey that showed a huge breakout in long-term inflation expectations is the problem with a premature pivot is that I think that it will cause the long end to blow out, a la the 1981 to 1982 period. So just a couple more comments there. So from 78 to 81, we had a very stagflationary time period. The Fed was extremely hawkish, hiked very aggressively, and with each Fed hike, it was followed a couple months later by a little bit of bear steepening in the back end. But what was really dramatic was by the end of 81, beginning of 82, the economy was in a recession. The Fed cut rather aggressively, but the market completely lost faith in the Fed's ability to keep the inflation genie out of the bottle, so to, in the bottle, so to speak. And you had this massive bull steepener that really blew out long end yields. So just something to think about, because if you get this massive steepener as a result of a premature pivot, gold might not actually be the safe haven everybody thinks it will be in that scenario.
Does anybody have any comments to Michael's points there? Especially curious about the panel's thoughts on gold. How do you feel about that notion that gold may well not be the safe haven that is expected?
At the beginning of the year, I put out a trade idea list, and on the list I had included gold, silver, Bitcoin, and Ethereum, just based on the simple idea that seemed almost too simple at the time, but it has worked out fairly well, which is obviously that the Fed was wants to pivot, wants to ease. M2 after, you know, money supply after maybe 2 years of contraction, which is highly unusual, was set to expand and has been expanding. And so I think that part of the rally in precious metals and let's say, you know, Bitcoin, whatever sort of store value you're looking at, is sort of has front run a pivot in central bank policy across the world from a very sort of contractionary position with respect to quantitative tightening globally, as well as higher rates, and sort of, you know, looking into the future into a Fed that's likely to cut rates, which again seems likely to happen in the coming months, as well as you know, reducing QT, which has already happened 2 months ago. And so I think that part of it is just reading the expectations and the forward guidance and sort of taking it at face value and sort of making the obvious trade based on that.
I think the other thing that I want to mention as it relates to gold is, you know, we very much highlighted the three reasons why, you know, not only are we likely to have a more inflationary environment, but why you know, gold is likely to be supported under a Trump election. You know, the obvious thing that we haven't talked about is if Trump doesn't get elected, and that I would still say that's less probable. But you know, we do have to consider that fact at this point. And if that were to pass, I think in the short term, given the positioning in gold, I think you know, gold could come under some significant pressure. So I think it's important to note, you know, what I'm laying out here in the short to medium term is, you know, an asymmetric trade if Trump is elected. In the short term, this is part of why you own vol in these days. This is why you own calls, not the outright underlying asset. Vol is underpriced given the asymmetric outcomes given in the election, given the potential risk, and positioning is relatively long of gold. There's a lot of focus on it. It would make sense in that environment for gold to liquidate before it takes another leg higher. I do still think, regardless of the candidate, more medium to long term, meaning multi-year, decade, is an incredible time to be long gold calls. But again, this is why you play in those calls. This is why you're long of vol. It is much more of an asymmetric trade in terms of distribution.
I wanted to touch a little again, and I know we briefly nipped the bud there earlier in the panel, but I wanted to touch on oil a little bit, and there seemed to be a little bit of, maybe not necessarily in what was said, but what's been posted in the past week. I believe Michael had said earlier, and he's posted about the macro risk to oil remaining to the downside, but kind of on the flip side of that, Martin has said, and I think this was just the other day, the level of hatred for oil is astounding. And Martin, I'm curious your thoughts on that. Do you think oil has more upside in there, or are we going to keep slipping in that front?
I think all oil needs to do is maintain its current levels. because there's just so much bearishness on the forward outlook. If you do believe in the numbers that we just talked about at the beginning of our conversations about U.S. GDP and it chugging along, the U.S. is still the largest consumer. And OPEC has done a fantastic job of maintaining global cuts. Russian output is potentially has peaked. And U.S. Production numbers are finally showing some weakness. There was a 60,000 barrel a day month over month decline in U.S. production in the last month, monthly data for May. And so I'm not of the camp that we get into a recession or a deep recession in the U.S. Emerging markets have been weaker for some time, especially out of China. But I think OPEC's done a really good job of navigating that and staying the course. We have not seen a geopolitical premium, in my opinion. You know, when you're talking about Iran itself and what's happening there, if this escalates and it starts to impact output there, then you know there's going to be some upside. But I think we're in a sweet spot. I think it's in a great place to be right now. It's not too high to hurt the consumer too bad, and it's not too low from an investor standpoint. A lot of these companies are forecasting in their forward cash flows a $60 barrel or $50, $60 barrel. And so if oil prices stay where they're at, which I think is a greater likelihood, then there's a lot of upside in these energy stocks. And then from a Trump perspective, I don't think there's a lot he can do to really to motivate and increase production immediately out of these U.S. shale producers who are all too keen on share buybacks and dividends.
Thank you, Martin. Michael, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, sure. I don't think the downside risk, downside supply risk, comes from more supply coming out of shale. It's more supply coming out of Saudi Arabia, because as you know, with 3 million, you know, Saudi Arabia used to produce 12 million barrels per day, and they're now at 9 million barrels per day, and that has inured to the benefit of mainly Iran and Russia, right? The Biden administration has basically not enforced any sanctions on Iran. And so one of the interesting things that I'll highlight from learning from my favorite oil analyst, Lakshmi, is that the effect of not enforcing sanctions on Iran over the last 4 years has, one, completely mobilized their tanker fleet from floating storage to now, you know, they've become very adept at basically dodging the U.S. system. And then they've also increased the size of their fleet by 19%. So even if a Trump administration wound up becoming really hawkish and on Iran and sanctioned them, there's limited curtailment, but there's this overhang of 3 million barrels per day from Saudis. And they're not happy with the fact that Russia, UAE, and Iran have basically gained market share at their expense. They are the only significant producer that can make up for lower prices with increased volumes. So that is why I think the geopolitical risk to oil is actually to the downside. You're not going to get all these... I think I've done pretty well over the last year, basically fading these types of headlines like we have today, because I think that you're just not going to see a runaway oil price scenario with that kind of overhang. It's more like a long position in oil is more like a call spread position. You're pretty much capped out at 90, in my opinion.
So we've got about 10 minutes before Jerome Powell's presser here. Does anybody have any general comments on any of the topics we've discussed, anything we maybe didn't get to enough that you wanted to comment on before I kick it around the panel for closing thoughts and anything you guys want to plug? So I actually did have one short topic, and I know short is a subjective thing to say with some of these, but I wanted to tickle the national debt because as many know, We've hit a new all-time high in the United States of $35 trillion, and many are, again, voicing concerns about a default in the future, which, as many of you may remember, was a really hot topic last year. And we will keep this one brief. We've only got about 10 minutes here, but we'll start with Martin again here and kick it around the panel. Martin, you commented on this earlier this week, likening the fiscal deficit spending to the 2008 financial crisis. Can you go over some of that for us here before we kick it to the presser?
Yeah, it makes absolutely no sense what's happening here. In Canada, we're complaining about our fiscal deficit, but it's nothing compared to what's happening south of the border. You've got the Fed trying to do what they're trying to deal with their dual mandate here. And then you've got Biden administration. Now, don't forget, the Trump administration did the same thing. You're talking about tax cuts with Trump. And so you're going to see that continue. I mean, it's insane that the interest payments are equivalent to military spending. And so this is my worry about the inflationary pressures being caused by this fiscal spending. Now, fortunately, the world is the world's reserve currency, and that does provide, I mean, from an outsider looking in, I don't think a lot of people in the U.S. appreciate that. I certainly do as being a Canadian. I wish we had the same kind of power with our currency, but we just don't. And so until that changes, and a lot of people have been talking about, maybe oil payments or whatever the case may be, but there just isn't a replacement to the USD. And that certainly provides them a lot of flexibility as to, talking default or any of those sorts of things is ridiculous. Until that reserve currency changes, it's steady as she goes, but it's just astounding to, as an outsider watching, outsider looking in, watching the spending there is just crazy, because we're not in a financial crisis, but they're spending like they are.
Thank you, Martin. Anybody have something to add there? Maybe Michael and Jim, I see your hands.
Yeah, if I can comment on here. So I completely agree with you, Martin, that the spending is out of control. Where I'm going to push back, though, is I actually commented about this yesterday. I basically said that, I think this whole trope that the Fed must cut because interest rate payments are on the debt are unsustainable. I think that's a trope, because I think that what people tend to do is you're making linear extrapolations off of inherently cyclical processes. And so I would invite, people to play this thought experiment with me, right? And say, how long would the Fed need to keep Fed funds at 10% to tamp down inflation expectations? I warrant not long, right? And it's just a thought experiment, right? But what I concluded that tweet with was that it's this Fed versus Treasury vodka Red Bull dynamic that's actually drawing things out and actually costing taxpayers more in the long run. But
sounds like we might have lost him there. Well, here we've got about 7 minutes left. Let's go ahead. I just want to run down the panel one at a time, just a few minutes each. Any kind of closing thoughts you have on the topics we covered today, be it gold, be it the treasuries, and then we'll be able to push these folks into Jerome Powell's presser and see how the market reacts. So now that we have Michael back, let's go ahead and start with Michael here, and then we'll move right down the line.
Sorry about that. I accidentally left the space for some reason, but I just wanted to conclude with just saying that, I don't think it's just the U.S. dollar being global reserve currency. I think that these processes are inherently cyclical, and if you want to look at how long this process can be strung along, it's a long, long, long time. I mean, look at what the Bank of Japan has done with debt to GDP of like 250%. And then if you look at the look-through debt of China and all its LGFV debt, it's more like, 350%. So I'm not concerned about U.S. default. I think that's just silly.
I just want to add one thing to that. I think, the word default, it can be a flexible word, much like money printing. We don't call QE money printing, but it's money printing, right? I think there are ways out of this, given the power of the Federal Reserve and the exorbitant privilege of the U.S. dollar. I think, like Mike said, we will string this out, and there are plenty of tools and the ability to do that. I would argue one of the interesting things that people don't talk about is the bigger, the connection between our debt and, you know, who holds the debt, right? The Fed can buy as much of the debt as it wants, internalize it much like Japan did, and then, you know, essentially digest it and move it over. And I think that will be the path. There's also any external debt. I think, you know, particularly as it relates to China, I think could be, you know, earmarked for some type of default, but it would be a political default given in the context of some bigger confrontation. I'll leave that there for people to noodle on, but I think there is a there's an increasing odds of greater confrontation with China if we get into a Trump presidency going forward. And I think that the debt could be restructured and things along those lines in the future, given that.
Thank you, Jim. Last Bear, anything you want to add here before we move on to the presser?
Yeah, first, thanks for having me, obviously. On the debt point, the only point I wanted to add was just for people to keep an eye out that the debt ceiling is not a firm number. It's actually a date. So it's January 1 will be of 2025 is when the Treasury can no longer continue to issue debt, which means it will start to spend down the cash that it has on hand, which will be about $750 billion. So in kind of a quirk in the way that the finances of the government work, we could be actually in for sort of a net influx of cash into the private sector as the Treasury spends down its balance starting January 1, 2025. Separate from that, obviously, if you like anything that I've said here, please follow me on Twitter, check out my Substack. But again, happy to be a part of this panel, and thanks for having me.
Thanks, as always, for coming, Last Bear. Martin, anything to add here at the tail end before the presser?
Yeah, I'll just, since I'm a money manager and run a fund, I'll throw a couple of ideas out there for the listeners in the space here. So overall, the U.S. economy is the best place to be globally, and it's going to continue to attract capital. European markets just don't look very attractive. Canada does not look as attractive other than those segments benefiting from interest rate cuts or those who are getting paid in U.S. dollars like Canadian energy stocks, which I just posted. It's done fantastic for us this year. So, you know, we're long and overweight in the U.S., but we want to hedge out all kinds of stuff that can happen. The markets are looking frothy here. The tech space happened with Microsoft yesterday is maybe a canary in the coal mine about expectations being priced in. You can hedge for us as a Canadian. We can hedge by owning our U.S. dollars, which we're quite happy to do so. You can also hedge by doing long-dated treasuries, which is a risky trade, but I think it's better than gold if you do worry about an economic contraction in the U.S. And then puts are really cheap. We're doing a lot of put spread callers on our S&P, so we're hedging out our full downside for the next 6 months with capped upside up to about 7 or 8%, and that's a great positioning for us in case the markets keep chugging along. We're going to get paid, but if something happens with the election or something else, we're protected. Puts are cheap, and so keep on hedging. Look at risk management. And awesome, thanks for having me on the panel today. It was such an honor to be with such super smart guests here, and I learned a lot. Thanks.
Yeah, I always learn the most on these panels, and I can't thank all of you enough for coming. Everybody who's here today, if you're not following the panelists that were here today, along with Joseph Wang, who had to dip a little early, definitely do so. They're always sharing insight on their Twitter pages, on their Substacks, appearing in interviews. You're gonna garner a lot from following these folks. I know I sure as hell do.